I'm Jeffrey Rosen. I'm the president of the National Constitution Center, the only institution in America required by Congress to disseminate information about the United States Constitution on a nonpartisan basis. Welcome to our discussion today about campaign financing and an important case in front of the Supreme Court in the first week of October, McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission. Joining me are David H. Ganz from the Constitutional Accountability Center and Ilya Shapiro from the Cato Institute. On October 8th, the Supreme Court spent an hour hearing McCutcheon, a new case that could test the basic rules of campaign financing. In 1976, the court ruled in the case of Buckley versus Valeo that Congress had extensive power to put limits on individual campaign contributions to federal candidates as a way to prevent corruption. But the court said it had less power to restrict expenditures independent of candidates by individuals and groups, and the court reasoned that limits on contributions rather than expenditures were less likely to raise the specter of corruption and less likely to threaten free speech. So the central constitutional question we'll be debating today is, what is corruption and what steps can Congress take consistent with the First Amendment to prevent it? In the 2010 case of Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, the court said that corporations and labor can spend just as much as they want on independent efforts to influence federal election outcomes and said this would not be corrupting. The Citizens United case seemed to narrow the definition of corruption from a broad concern about the appearance of a government that was dependent on the rich to a more narrow requirement of quid pro quo corruption. And the question in front of the court in McCutcheon is what restrictions the Constitution allows the government to continue to put on spending in federal election. That question turns on what kind of corruption the Constitution allows Congress to avoid. The case was filed by Sean McCutcheon, an Alabama businessman, and the Republican National Committee. McCutcheon challenges the ideas of aggregate limits on individual donations. In a two-year election cycle, a person can donate an aggregate of $48,600 to all candidates for federal offices, another $74,600 to national political parties, state and local political parties, and donations are limited to $2,600 per election. McCutcheon claims the total limit of $123,200 violates his First Amendment right to free speech. I want to ask our panelists, should the distinction that was drawn in Buckley versus Valeo between limitations on contributions, which are permissible to prevent corruption, and limitations on expenditure, which are not, should that be maintained, or should Buckley versus Valeo be overruled, as Justice Clarence Thomas and some other justices have signaled? And I'll begin by asking Ilya that question. In your brief for the Cato, in the brief filed by the Cato Institute, Cato argues that Buckley should be overruled. Why is that, and why should the distinction between contributions and expenditures be eliminated?
Thanks for that question, Jeff. That exactly tees up our brief, which I think goes broader than what the court will necessarily have to decide in this case. But I do think that Buckley rewrote the legislation that was passed in the wake of Watergate and created the modern campaign finance system, which has been later amended by legislation and court decision, in a way that makes for an unstable and now increasingly unworkable system. I don't think that the distinction between expenditures and contributions on a constitutional First Amendment level can really be maintained, because after all, just like banning the printing press or access to the internet can be a violation of the First Amendment, restricting or banning money that is facilitating political speech it also raises the same sorts of concerns. So I think that this is a fairly easier case in that respect about the aggregate limits. You know, why can you max out to 9 candidates, but then one more dollar to that 10th one all of a sudden becomes corrupting? But the broader issue you raise, I think, is in the shadows here and might come up in the future. And fundamentally, I think, both in terms of as a matter of policy and as a matter of First Amendment law, we're going to have to rethink the Buckley framework.
David, what do you think about the claim that the Buckley framework should be overturned? And tell us more about whether the Buckley framework rests on an unnecessarily narrow notion of corruption.
So first, I want to point out the claim that Ilya is making, which was also made in the is made to some extent by the Republican National Committee as well as Senator McConnell, is really a radical one that's never been accepted by any court in history. There's no court that has said you have as a matter of the First Amendment's protection of freedom of speech, the right to make unlimited campaign contributions. And I think that rests on a very common sense view that campaign contributions are a petri dish for corruption, and that's something that we've seen in Watergate that led to the modern campaign finance laws. We've seen that kind of all the way back to the Gilded Age, and that's really never been our understanding of freedom of speech. And I think one of the things that's telling is you didn't see Justice Scalia, Justice Kennedy offer any understanding why the First Amendment gives that same protection to campaign contributions. Never articulated that First Amendment defense. That was something that I thought was very much missing. The case yesterday was focusing very intensely on corruption, and I think really the answer that the court needs to address is, let's not just make up our own understanding of corruption, let's look at the Constitution's text and history. And one of the things that I think many people are not aware of is that the framers were very intensely concerned about corruption, and the debates over the Constitution revolved to a great deal over how the government could be created that would prevent corruption. That was one of the framers' leading concerns, and they created a representative democracy that was by, of, and for the people, as Madison said, not for the rich more than for the poor, and they were concerned that the government could be corrupted by improper dependence on the few, though that might be foreign patrons, that might be local factions. And I think the great concern about McCutcheon is you strike down these aggregate limits and you open the door to multi-million dollar contributions. And I think, as General Verrilli pointed out, these limits are a bulwark against a system in which donors can cut multi-million dollar checks. The court upheld these aggregate limits in Buckley, and they should do so here as well.
So, Ilya, let's really focus in, if you would, on David's very interesting claim, which appears in the brief filed by the Constitutional Accountability Center, that the framers of the Constitution would have supported broad limits on contributions and expenditures because the corruption they were concerned about combating wasn't just quid pro quo corruption, take this contribution and get me a land deal. It was a broader concern about what he calls dependence corruption, that basically the entire structure of government would be dependent on particular cabals, aristocratic people, rich people, and therefore that citizens would lack trust in them. You reject that notion in your brief. Tell us why a good originalist like Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas shouldn't be persuaded by David that the framers of the Constitution would have defined corruption as broadly as he says.
Well, the Constitutional Accountability Center's brief is very interesting on behalf of Professor Larry Lessig of Harvard. I've talked about these issues with Professor Lessig, and it's accurate historical presentation of the definition of corruption and what the founders thought about it. But you have to remember that was a different political age. The franchise, the right to vote, was limited to propertied gentlemen of a certain class. The way that elections were conducted, you got your voters essentially drunk. You had a lot of spirits lined up, and the ballot wasn't even secret. So there are a lot of things that are different about the political process then than now. And these concerns about systemic corruption, while still certainly present and valid in the abstract, I think are taken care of by other laws we have with respect to voting rights, with respect to disclosures. I mean, I think it would be great to have, sure, let those handful of people that want to spend their money on the political process, maybe they should be donating to Cato or the National Constitutional Center or Constitutional Accountability Center instead, but anyhow, they want to do that. But let the voters then decide whether they want to vote for a candidate that's wholly financed by George Soros or Sheldon Adelson or whoever the case may be. I think this is a solution in search of a problem, this attempt to have these aggregate limits. I think, again, that's an easier case than the individual limits on a candidate, but it seems strange that you can spend $120,000, but one more dollar to one more candidate all of a sudden starts corrupting the system.
Well, this is fascinating. So, David, you just got high praise from Ilya for the Lessig brief. He says it's historically accurate, but times have changed, and now other things like disclosure limits can address those
concerns.
Certainly
there are aspects of our constitutional system that have changed, and certainly we've had all sorts of amendments that have given greater protection to the right to vote. and the Supreme Court should be paying more attention to those than it does, but there's no reason that we should reject, you know, that this fundamental principle that Madison sets out, that this is a representative democracy that is not for the rich more than the poor. And the question is, will the Supreme Court, will originalists like Scalia live up to that, or will they say, well, you know, to us it doesn't seem like $3.6 million is a lot when you know, that's the 1% of the 1% of the 1%. And for most people, having the ability to put that kind of money in the political system is just not, feasible. And it distorts, the representative democracy that our Constitution forms. And the government does have the power.
Forgive me. I was just going to put the question back to Ilya. You suggest that Justice Scalia says the Constitution means what it meant in 1787. So he's not a living constitutionalist, and therefore, why, Ilya, is it appropriate for someone like Scalia or Justice Thomas to embrace the argument that you just made, which is that times have changed?
Well, it's not that the Constitution has changed, and let's be clear about that. It's not that there was a scheme to limit total campaign donations or, you know, the some sort of equivalent to McCain-Feingold or the Buckley versus Valeo era framework that we can just transpose. It's what we have to understand is how do you take those concerns about systemic corruption, what do those very valid concerns mean in the present day? And in the present day, that means certainly you don't allow vote buying, certainly you don't allow quid pro quo corruption. There's a lot of concerns with lobbying, for example, on the back end. In fact, 10 or 12 times more money is spent on lobbying than is on campaigning. So you have to look at things more systematically and also fundamentally see whether whatever concerns and however your articulation of the corruption, the anti-corruption interest is in comparison to the founders' very fundamental belief that political speech is at the core of the liberty that the Constitution is meant to protect. And I just don't see how these aggregate limits do anything to prevent corruption of the system or any individual politician.
I mean,
great.
I
so
will
David,
say,
Ilya makes a strong point. He says, okay, I grant that dependence corruption, systemic corruption is what the framers were concerned about. We just disagree about what will prevent that kind of corruption. And the Cato brief, which is quite strong in its arguments, says that studies indicates campaign spending doesn't diminish trust in government, and also that candidates have to spend so much time raising money given these limits that makes them more vulnerable to systemic corruption, not less. What's your response to that?
Well, so, I mean, let me just point out, so if Ilya is accepting that our history is right, then by definition, Kennedy's view that that the only kind of corruption is quid pro quo corruption is wrong, because as our brief shows, among the framers, that was rare. The framers were much more concerned about improper dependence. So that's, that is a fundamental point that really goes to the heart of the issues in McCutcheon.
Just on that point, and I want you to make your second one in a moment, but your brief rather magnanimously says our view is consistent with the Citizens United case. But in fact, you've just suggested that a hard look at Citizens United would suggest that it defined corruption more narrowly than the framers would have.
Well, so I think our brief said it was consistent with the result in Citizens United. Our brief.
This came up in argument yesterday, actually. And Dave, sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you, but I think that's actually a key point. Breyer, Scalia, Kennedy, in yesterday's argument, they all talked about this weird dichotomy between independent, liberalized political speech after Citizens United, but this kind of cabined, restricted campaign or party speech, and the average voter can't really see the difference between them. So what does that mean for the law? And the justices might come out on different ways because of that, but I think that is an important aspect of this case.
Well, I mean, it goes back to the Buckley framework, which was expenditures were not viewed as corrupting and contributions were. And I think if you apply that framework, which has been reaffirmed countless times, that means aggregate contributions, especially when you're talking about multimillion-dollar contributions, do have that inherent corruptive potential that should be upheld.
Can I ask another point of clarification? Buckley, as you both seem to be agreeing, said that limits on contributions are justified because contributions are more likely to corrupt than expenditures. But Buckley also said that caps on campaign expenditures but not contributions are restrictions on political speech. And the reasoning was that while contributions may result in political expression if spent by a candidate or an association, the transformation of contributions into political debate involves speech by someone other than the contributor. And by contrast, expenditure limits represent substantial rather than theoretical restraints on the quality and diversity of political speech. Is it correct that Buckley, the distinction between contributions and expenditures rested not only on a concern about corruption, but also on the thought that there was more expressive content to expenditures than contributions, Ilya?
I think that's right. I think that is part of Buckley, and you know, I would question that, but certainly I think that is part of that distinction. And I think it's wrong because when you make that political contribution, you are saying that you know you agree with that candidate, you agree with that party or policy or whatever the case may be. It's really not that different from the independent political speech. It all goes towards the same sorts of political ads or what have you.
Agree with Buckley that basically second party speech and therefore expenditures have more First Amendment content than the contributions.
Well, right. So I think what Buckley said was they don't see it quite a strong claim to First Amendment protection as, say, a campaign ad. And, you know, there's just, I mean, I think the fundamental point is you're dealing with a direct cash transfer to a candidate, and that's, you know, history tells us that's the petri dish of corruption. And the government's interest, especially once we kind of focus on the text and history of the Constitution, is the government's interest has to be at its highest point in that case. And, you know, I think if the court kind of reflects both on its precedents and on the text and history, you know, the answer should be the answer in Buckley. These kinds of limits should be upheld.
So I was going to ask, if you were both writing from scratch, where would you draw the line, like Buckley or somewhere else? Ilya, you know, like this Constitutional Accountability Center, you take text and history seriously at Cato. If the justices were writing on a clean slate, no campaign regulations at all, or what would be permissible and consistent with the First Amendment?
I think I have a wry sort of law review article on this called Stephen Colbert's Right to Lampoon Our Campaign Finance System, and So Can You. I do think that especially with the possibility for instant disclosure and the internet and information getting out, that unlimited contributions or at least very high ones, indexed to inflation, that sort of thing, combined with instant disclosure above a certain level. I don't think the interest in discovering the little old lady donating $20 is outweighed by the potential for harassing her and those sorts of things. But so there are details, technicalities. But I do think fewer limits and more transparency is the way to go.
And David, if you were writing would you draw the line at Buckley or some other way?
I mean, I think just about everyone can agree that there are the distinction between contributions and expenditures is has not been a satisfactory one. I mean, I'll sort of point to one example from yesterday's argument. I think Kennedy, you know, after authoring Citizens United, suggested, well, actually, you know, the person who spends millions of dollars on electoral ads, you know, might have a greater claim to the politician's ear than a campaign contributor, which suggests that you know there are the answer of only contributions are corrupting and expenditures by definition are not is hard to square with basic common sense and sort of what we see on the ground. So I think
questions. I agree with that point, but I would draw the opposite conclusion. That if you're going to liberalize independent speech, which I think you know Citizens United was correct, then you can't imbalance the playing field in that sort of way. Parties and candidates don't have any special First Amendment rights, but I think they should have just as much as independent speakers, and that's part of the reason why the current system I think is unworkable.
So Ilya's solution is deregulation. David, is yours complete regulations? You would restrict both expenditures and contributions, or some other solution?
No, I don't. I mean, I don't think I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think, you know, obviously, you know, the First Amendment balance is one that has to be respected. But I think, you know, I think you have to attend to both. To both the First Amendment balance as well as the interest on the other side of the equation, which is also sort of constitutionally backed, one in terms of, you know, this interest in ensuring a government free of corruption. And again, you know, I go back to sort of this sort of fundamental point that Madison made, that our government was not to be for the rich more than for the poor. And I think, you know, the Supreme Court's precedents have kind of escalated a tendency in that regard, and I think there's line drawing to be done, but I think on the whole there has to be much more respect for the government's interest in deterring actual and apparent corruption. And I think, you know, part of the problem is that the justices have really ignored the text and history that makes this plain, and you know, I think that's one of the signal importances of our brief, which is to kind of set out this history and show how powerful it is.
But part of
wonderful.
Part of it is a factual dispute, and you know, we're not just talking in abstractly about theory and differing views of history, and in fact we agree on the history, just disagree on the interpretation or the application to the modern day. But there are about 20 states, give or take, that don't have restrictions on campaign donations in state campaigns, and there's no indication whatsoever that those states are more corrupt than other states. In fact, for example, Illinois and California, which are, you know, are remarkable instances now of either corruption or broken government or what have you, have some of the most severe and regulated campaign finance law of all. And there's other states in different parts of the country, red and blue, that have gone a different way.
I mean,
Go ahead, David.
I mean, I would only say, you know, the case for federal limits, you know, is very much one of responding to massive corruption violations. I mean, we have these limits because of Watergate and because wealthy individuals and businesses were pumping, you know, huge dollars into the political system because they saw that there were advantages and gains in the political process to be won by that regard. So I think, you know, history shows the need for regulation of campaign financing to protect against actual and apparent corruption.
That is a powerful note on which to end. In this vigorous debate, you both have agreed about the relevance of text and history and also the broad notion of dependence corruption that the framers meant to protect, but you have disagreed about the applicability of that in the present day and how we should translate constitutional values to protect the same kind of expression in the age of the Internet that the framers took for granted. David Grant and Ilya Shapiro, I want to thank you so much for a fascinating debate and look forward to talking to you again soon. Jeffrey Rosen from the National Constitution Center, thank you very much.